Side 7. Mona Lisa Overdrive by William Gibson. Continuing on page 293. The lights dimmed when Gentry and Slick found their connection, and she thought she heard the face on the monitor gasp, but she was already moving toward Angie, seeing, suddenly, totally, so clearly it hurt, the fine line of blood from her left ear. Even then the stillness held, though already she could feel raw, hot points in the back of her throat, and remember Lynette explaining, "You don't ever snort this, it eats holes in you." And Molly's back was straight, her arms stretched out, straight out and down, not to that gray box, but to her pistol, that little thing, and Mona heard it go snick, 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 and then three explosions, far off down there, and they must have been blue flashes, but Mona's hands were around Angie now, wrists brushed by blood-smeared fur, to look into gone eyes, the light already fading, just a long, longest way away. "Hey," Mona said, nobody to hear, just Angie toppling across the corpse in the sleeping bag. "Hey." She glanced up in time to catch a last image on that vid screen and see it fade. After that, for a long time, nothing mattered. It wasn't like the not caring of the stillness, the crystal overdrive, and it wasn't like crashing, just this past-it feeling, the way maybe a ghost feels. She stood beside Slick and Molly in the doorway and looked down. In the dim glare of big old bulbs, she watched a metal spider thing jittering across the dirty concrete floor. It had big curved blades that snapped and whirled when it moved, but there was nobody in there moving, and the thing just went like a broken toy, back and forth in front of the twisted wreck of the little bridge she'd crossed with Angie and Cherry. Cherry had gotten up from the floor, pale and slack-faced, and peeled the derm from her neck. "That's mage muscle relaxant," she managed, and Mona felt bad because she knew she'd done something stupid when she'd thought she was trying to help, but Wiz always did that, and how come she couldn't stop doing it? "Because you're wired, stupid," she heard Lynette say, but she hadn't wanted to remember that. So they all just stood there, looking down at the metal spider twitching and running itself down, all except Gentry, who was unscrewing the gray box from its frame over the stretcher, his black boots beside Angie's red fur. "Listen," Molly said, "that's a copter. Big one." She was the last one down the rope, except for Gentry, and he just said he wasn't coming, didn't care, he'd stay. The rope was fat and dirty gray and had knots tied in it to hang on to, like a swing she remembered from a long time ago. Slick and Molly had lowered the gray box first, down to a platform where the metal stairs weren't wrecked. Then Molly went down it like a squirrel, seeming barely to hang on at all, and tied it tight to a railing. Slick went down slowly, because he had Cherry over his shoulder, and she was still too relaxed to make it down herself. Mona still felt bad about that, and wondered if that was why they'd decided to leave her there. It was Molly who'd decided, though, standing there by that window, watching people pop out of the long black helicopter and spread out across the snow. "Look at that," Molly said. "They know. Just come to pick up the pieces. Sense net. My ass is out of here." Cherry slurred that they were leaving too, she and Slick, and Slick shrugged, then grinned and put his arm around her.
"What about me?"
Molly looked at her, or seemed to. Couldn't really tell with the glasses. White tooth showed against her lower lip for just a second. Then she said, "You stay, my advice. Let them sort it out. You haven't really done anything. None of it was your idea. Think they'll probably do right by you, or try to. Yeah, you stay." It didn't make any sense to Mona, but now she felt so dead, so crash sick, she couldn't argue. And then they were just gone, down the rope and gone, and it was just like that, how people left, and you didn't ever see them anymore. She looked back into the room and saw Gentry pacing back and forth in front of his books, running the tip of his finger along them like he was looking for a special one. He'd thrown a blanket over the stretcher. So she just left, and she wouldn't know if Gentry ever found his book or not. But that was how it was. So she climbed down the rope herself, which wasn't as easy as Molly and Slick had made it look, particularly if you felt like Mona did, because Mona felt close to blacking out, and her arms and legs didn't seem to be working real good anyway. She had to sort of concentrate on making the move, and her nose and throat were swelling inside, so she didn't notice the black guy until she was all the way down. He was standing there looking at the big spider thing, which wasn't moving at all. Looked up when the heel of her shoe grated across the steel platform. And something so sad about his face when he saw her. But then it was gone, and he was climbing the metal stairs, slow and easy. And as he got closer, she began to wonder if he really was black. Not just the color, which he definitely was, but there was something about the shape of his bald skull, the angles of his face, not quite like anybody she'd seen before. He was tall, real tall, wore a long black coat, leather so thin it moved like silk. "Hello, Missy," he said when he stood in front of her, reached out to raise her chin so she was looking straight into gold-flecked agate eyes like nobody in the world ever had. Long fingers so light against her chin. "Missy," he said, "how old are you?"
16.
"You need a haircut," he said. And there was something so serious about how he said it.
"Angie's up there," she said, pointing, when she found her voice again. "She's..."
"Hush." She heard metal noises far away in the big old building, and then a motor starting up. The hover, she thought, the one Molly'd driven here. The black man raised his eyebrows, except he didn't have any eyebrows. "Friends?" He lowered his hand. She nodded. "Good enough," he said, and took her hand to help her down the stairs. At the bottom, still holding her hand, he led her around the wreck of the catwalk thing. Somebody was dead there. Camo material and one of those big voice things like cops have. "Swift," the black man called, out across that whole tall, hollow space, between the black grids of windows without any glass, black lines against a white sky, winter morning. "Get your ass over here. I found her."
"But I'm not her."
And over there, where the big doors stood open, against the sky and snow and rust, she saw this suit come walking, with his coat open and his tie flapping in the wind, and Molly's hover swung past him, out those same doors, and he wasn't even looking, because he was looking at Mona.
"I'm not Angie," she said,
and wondered if she ought to tell him what she'd seen, Angie and the young guy together on that little screen, just before it faded. "I know," the black man said. "But it grows on you."
Rapture. Rapture's coming.
43. Judge. The woman led them to a hovercraft parked inside factory, if you could call it parking, when the front end was mashed up around a concrete tool mount. It was a white cargo job with Cathode Cathay lettered across the rear doors, and Slick wondered when she'd managed to get it in there without him hearing it. Maybe while Bobby the Count was pulling his diversion with the blimp. The Aleph was heavy, like trying to carry a small engine block. He didn't want to look at the witch, because there was blood on her blades, and he hadn't made her for that. There were a couple of bodies around, or parts of them. He didn't look at that either. He looked down at the block of Biosoft and its battery pack, and wondered if all that was still in there, the gray house and Mexico and Three Jane's eyes. "Wait," the woman said. They were passing the ramp to the room where he kept his machines. The judge was still there, the corpse grinder. She still had her gun in her hand. Slick put his hand on Cherry's shoulder. She said, "Wait." "That thing I saw last night," the woman said. "One-armed robot. That work?"
"Yeah."
"Strong? Carry a load? Over rough ground?"
"Yeah."
"Get it."
"Huh?"
"Get it into the back of the hover. Now, move!" Cherry clung to him, weak-kneed from whatever it was that girl had given her. You, Molly gestured toward her with the gun. Into the hover.
Go on, Slick said.
He set the Aleph down and walked up the ramp and into the room where the judge was waiting in the shadows, the arm beside it on the tarp where Slick had left it. Now he wouldn't ever get it right, how the saw was supposed to work. There was a control unit there, on a row of dusty metal shelves. He picked it up and let the judge power up, the brown carapace trembling slightly. He moved the judge forward, down the ramp, the broad feet coming down, one, two, one, two. The gyros compensating, perfecting for the missing arm. The woman had the rear doors of the hover open, ready, and Slick marched the judge straight over to her. She fell back slightly as the judge towered over her, her silver glasses reflecting polished rust. Slick came up behind the judge and started figuring the angles, how to get him in there. It didn't make sense, but at least she seemed to have some idea of what they were doing, and anything was better than hanging around factory now, with dead people all over. He thought about Gentry, up there with his books and those bodies. There'd been two girls up there, and they'd both looked like Angie Mitchell. Now one of them was dead. He didn't know how or why, and the woman with the gun had told the other one to wait. Come on, come on, get the fucking thing in. We gotta go. When he'd managed to work the judge into the back of the hover, legs bent, on its side, he slammed the doors, ran around, and climbed in on the passenger side. The Aleph was between the front seats. Cherry was curled in the back seat, under a big orange parka with the SenseNet logo on the sleeve, shivering. The woman fired up the turbine and inflated the bag. Slick thought they might be hung on the tool mount, but when she reversed, it tore away a strip of chrome, and they were free. She swung the hover around and headed for the gates. On the way out, they passed a guy in a suit and tie and a tweed overcoat who didn't seem to see them. Who's that? She shrugged. You want this hover? She asked. They were maybe 10 kilos from factory now, and he hadn't looked back. You steal it?
Sure.
I'll pass.
Yeah?
I did time. Car theft.
So how's your girlfriend?
Asleep. She's not my girlfriend.
No?
I get to ask who you are.
A businesswoman.
What business?
Hard to say.
The sky above the solitude was bright and white. You come for this? He tapped the Aleph.
Sort of.
What now?
I made a deal. I got Mitchell together with the box.
That was her, the one who fell over?
Yeah, that was her.
But she died.
There's dying, then there's dying.
Like 3 Jane? Her head moved, like she glanced at him.
What do you know about that?
I saw her once, in there.
Well, she's still in there, but so's Angie.
And Bobby?
Newmark, yeah.
So what'll you do with it?
You built those things, right? One in the back, the others.
Slick glanced back over his shoulder to where the judge was folded in the hover's cargo space, like a big rusty headless doll.
Yeah. So you're good with tools?
Guess so.
Okay, I got a job for you.
She slowed the hover beside a ragged crest of snow-covered scrap and coasted to a halt. There'll be an emergency kit in here somewhere. Get it. Get up on the roof. Get me the solar cells and some wire. I want you to rig the cells so they'll recharge this thing's battery. Can you do that?
Probably.
Why? She sank back in the seat and Slick saw that she was older than he'd thought, and tired. Mitchell's in there now. They want her to have some time, is all.
They?
I don't know. Something.
Whatever I cut my deal with.
How long you figure the battery'll hold out if the cells work?
Couple months.
Year, maybe.
Okay, I'll hide it somewhere, where the cells can get the sun.
What happens if you just cut the power? She reached down and ran the tip of her index finger along the thin cable that connected the Aleph to the battery. Slick saw her fingernails in the morning light. They looked artificial. "Hey, 3Jane," she said, her finger poised above the cable. "I gotcha." Then her hand was a fist, which opened as though she were letting something go. Cherry wanted to tell Slick everything they were going to do when they got to Cleveland. He was lashing two of the flat cells to the judge's broad chest with silver tape. The gray Aleph was already fastened to the machine's back with a harness of tape. Cherry said she knew where she could get him a job fixing rides in an arcade. He wasn't really listening. When he'd gotten it all together, he handed the control unit to the woman. "Guess we wait for you now." "No," she said. "You go to Cleveland. Cherry just told you."
"What about you?"
"I'm going for a walk."
"You want to freeze? Maybe want to starve?
Want to be by my fucking self for a change?"
She tried the controls, and the judge trembled, took a step forward, another. "Good luck in Cleveland." They watched her walk out across the solitude, the judge clumping along behind her. Then she turned and yelled back, "Hey, Cherry, get that guy to take a bath." Cherry waved, the zippers of her leather jackets jingling. 44. Red Leather. Petal said that her bags were waiting in the Jaguar. "You won't want to be coming back to Notting Hill," he said, "so we've arranged something for you in Camden Town."
"Petal," she said, "I have to know what has happened to Sally."
He started the engine.
"Swain was blackmailing her, forcing her to kidnap—"
"Ah, oh, well then," he interrupted. "I see. Shouldn't worry if I were you."
"I am worried."
"Sally, I would say, has managed to extricate herself from that little matter. She's also, according to certain official friends of ours, managed to cause all record of herself to evaporate, apparently, except for a controlling interest in a German casino. And if anything's happened to Angela Mitchell since Net hasn't gone public with it, all of that is done with now."
"Will I see her again?"
"Not on my parish, please." They pulled away from the curb.
"Petal," she said, as they drove through London, "my father told me that Swain—"
"Fool, bloody fool. Better not talk about it now."
"I'm sorry."
The heater was working. It was warm in the Jaguar, and Kumiko was very tired now. She settled back against Red Leather and closed her eyes. Somehow, she thought, her meeting with 3Jane had freed her of her shame, and her father's answer of her anger. 3Jane had been very cruel. Now she saw her mother's cruelty as well. But all must be forgiven one day, she thought, and fell asleep on the way to a place called Camden Town. 45. Smooth Stone Beyond. They have come to live in this house, walls of gray stone, roof of slate, in the season of early summer. The grounds are bright and wild, though the long grass does not grow, and the wildflowers do not fade. Behind the house are outbuildings, unopened, unexplored, and a field where tethered gliders strain against the wind. Once, walking alone among the oaks at the edge of that field, she saw three strangers, astride something approximately resembling a horse. Horses are extinct, their line terminated years before Angie's birth. A slim, tweed-coated figure was in the saddle, a boy like a groom from some old painting. In front of him, a young girl, Japanese, straddled the horse thing, while behind him sat a pale, greasy-looking little man in a gray suit, pink socks and white ankles showing above his brown shoes. Had the girl seen her, returned her gaze? She had forgotten to mention this to Bobby. Their most frequent visitors arrive in dawn dreams, though once a grinning little kobold of a man announced himself by thumping repeatedly on the heavy oak door, demanding, when she ran to open it, "That little shit, Newmark!" Bobby introduced this creature as the Finn, and seemed delighted to see him. The Finn's decrepit jacket exuded a complex odor of stale smoke, ancient solder, and pickled herring. Bobby explained that the Finn was always welcome. Might as well be. No way to keep him out, once he wants in. Three Jane comes as well, one of the dawn visitors, her presence sad and tentative. Bobby seems scarcely aware of her, but Angie, the repository of so many of her memories, resonates to that particular mingling of longing, jealousy, frustration, and rage. Angie has come to understand Three Jane's motives, and to forgive her. Though what exactly, wandering amid these oaks in sunlight, is there to forgive? The dreams of Three Jane sometimes weary Angie. She prefers other dreams, particularly those of her young protégé. These often come as the lace curtains billow, as a first bird calls. She rolls closer to Bobby, closes her eyes, forms the name Continuity in her mind, and waits for the small bright images. She sees that they have taken the girl to a clinic in Jamaica to treat her addiction to crude stimulants. Her metabolism fine-tuned by a patient army of net medics, she emerges at last radiant with health. With her sensorium expertly modulated by Piper Hill, her first stims are greeted with unprecedented enthusiasm. Her global audience is entranced by her freshness, her vigor, the delightfully ingenuous way in which she seems to discover her glamorous life as if for the first time. A shadow sometimes crosses the distant screen, but only for an instant. Robin Lanier has been found strangled, frozen, on the mountainscaped facade of the new Suzuki Envoy. Both Angie and Continuity know whose long, strong hands throttled the star and threw him there. But a certain thing eludes her, one special fragment of the puzzle that is history. At the edge of oak shadow, beneath a steel and salmon sunset, in this France that isn't France, she asks Bobby for the answer to her final question. They waited in the drive at midnight, because Bobby had promised her an answer. As the clocks in the house struck 12, she heard the hiss of tires over gravel. The car was long, low, and gray. Its driver was the Finn. Bobby opened the door and helped her in. In the back seat sat the young man she recalled from her glimpse of the impossible horse and its three mismatched riders. He smiled at her, but said nothing. "This is Colin," Bobby said, climbing in beside her. "And you know the Finn." "She never guessed, huh?" the Finn asked, putting the car in gear. "No," Bobby said. "I don't think so." The young man named Colin was smiling at her. "The Aleph is an approximation of the Matrix," he said. "A sort of model of cyberspace."
"Yes, I know."
She turned to Bobby.
"Well, you promised you'd tell me the why of when it changed."
The Finn laughed, a very strange sound. "Ain't a why, lady. More like it's a what. Remember one time Brigitte told you there was this other?"
"Yeah."
"Well, that's the what. And the what's the why."
"I do remember. She said that when the Matrix finally knew itself, there was the other."
"That's where we're going tonight," Bobby began, putting his arm around her. "It isn't far, but it's
different," the Finn said. "It's real different."
"But what is it?"
"You see," Colin said, brushing aside his brown forelock, a gesture like a schoolboy's in some antique play, "when the Matrix attained sentience, it simultaneously became aware of another Matrix, another sentience."
"I don't understand," she said. "If cyberspace consists of the sum total of data in the human system..."
"Yeah," the Finn said, turning out onto the long, straight, empty highway. "But nobody's talking human, see?"
"The other one was somewhere else," Bobby said.
"Centauri.
Colin said. Can they be teasing her? Is this some joke of Bobby's?
So it's kind of hard to explain why the Matrix split up into all those hoodoos and shit when it met this other one, the Finn said. But when we get there, you'll sort of get the idea.
My own feeling, Colin said, is that it's all so much more amusing this way. Are you telling me the truth?
Be there in a New York minute, said the Finn. No shit.
End of Mona Lisa Overdrive by William Gibson. Read by James D. Lotel in the studios of the American Printing House for the Blind, Louisville, Kentucky, for the Library of Congress, December 1994. For special distribution, as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Bantam Books, 666 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10103. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.